Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me in my virtual studio, I have Megan Schoritz, all the way from beautiful Cape Town. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan, to introduce you to the listeners, you are I don't know where to start because you have so many similar. You're an actor, a writer, an improviser, a director, a vegan, an anti-racist, a tarot card reader, an anti-Zionist, and an author. The floor is yours. Introduce yourself better to the listeners.
So it's interesting that you ask me that because I make quite a lot of content on social media, and this is how I normally introduce myself. Hi, my name is Megan. I'm a South African. I'm a Jew. I'm an anti-Zionist. I'm an anti-racist. And those are kind of the labels that I prefer right now. In the world that we inhabit, it seems that it's quite important to set up our identities right up front.
I must admit I agree with you because the reason I don't know where to start with you is because we actually have a lot of similarities, okay? Both South African-born, both grew up in the apartheid era, both grew up in families that, though the families recognized the injustices, they did nothing about them. Although I think like you, my family just wanted me to be safe, so they let me be who I needed to be. And this identity of always being on the wrong side, the apparent wrong side, because you're always on the other side, which I'm very comfortable with, okay? Because the only side I'm happy with is the side that lets me sleep at night. I've just got to be at peace with myself.
Although I have to say that getting older, this sleep, trying to sleep at night is not for sissies. I think I had four hours last night, which for me doesn't feel like it's enough, but it's better than nothing, I guess. Yeah. Sleep. I would love more sleep.
I have to agree with you. And I think that's a good place to start at because, you're a Jew, yet you're an anti-Zionist. And I think that's a good place to start because critical thinkers know the difference between being a Zionist and a Jew, okay? And then it's not one and the same. But I think explain to the listeners why it's not the same because I'm in a personal dilemma. Now I'm going to an AGM of a bigger European organization and I'm having the Jewish woman putting on the table the fact that anti-Semitics are being anti, that they're using the anti-Semitic and the anti-Zionist as being a bad thing and they're weaponizing it. And it's challenging me because I don't know how to, not that I know how to fight it, but it goes so deep inside my soul. So please explain it to me why it's different.
Well,
or where it's different is probably a better word.
Yes. So being Jewish is different from a political construct as a colonial ethno-nationalist construct and that's what Zionism is. Zionism is Jewish supremacy. It's white supremacy. And, Zionism is a colonial racist apartheid system that has got nothing to do with being Jewish. It's totally separate from being Jewish. When you are Jewish, you are Jewish beyond any kind of politics or any kind of political construct. And Zionism and the state of Israel is political. It's got, and colonial. It's got nothing to do with Judaism. So much so that if you look at the history of Zionism and how Zionism was created, it was created quite unapologetically to be a racist, supremacist, ethno-state. And actually people didn't really, at the time of Theodor Herzl, when they were discussing it, first of all, Theodor Herzl was an atheist. He wasn't a religious Jew in any way. He wasn't a believer, but so it was a eugenics kind of thing. It was very similar, honestly, to a kind of Nazi way of thinking, which was quite simply...
We are better.
We think Jews need a homeland. They need an ethno-state. And interestingly enough, in the very beginning, obviously before the Balfour Declaration and before the State of Israel was declared, there was this notion that might is right. You had to be the right kind of Jew to be in Palestine, soon to be Israel, because you had to be strong enough, ethnically cleanse, the land of Palestinians. That was the whole point. So even when the first wave of World War II refugees started coming, there was a problem because these people were starved and weak and disenfranchised and not necessarily the right kind of Jews you wanted to go and get involved in a bit of ethnic cleansing.
You have been an anti-Zionist forever. It's not something new or something that came on with October the 7th, 2023. How popular did that make it? I'm using popular in a generic kind of form. How easy was it to navigate being a Jewish in South Africa and being an anti-Zionist? Because there was a very, very strong Jewish community in South Africa, especially in the years of apartheid.
It wasn't something it was easy because people didn't take me seriously. And so I was able to shout loudly or complain or take my family to task or comment, and be clear about my stance, particularly, in the 2000s with the first and second intifada, the March of the Great Return and, the first genocides of Gaza. So people would kind of sort of notice that I was saying something, but no one ever took me very seriously. And, the interesting part of that was just before, the 7th of October, 2023, I'd been raging on various social media platforms about what had been happening pretty much since 2012. And with a growing frustration because what was happening in the West Bank was abominable with the beginnings of the new, illegal settler communities. And we were watching the daily abuses, in the West Bank more and more, but no one was saying or doing a single thing. There was very little conversation about it. And certainly people saw me in South Africa as, you know, she's fantastic and she's creative and she's written this amazing book and she's directed these amazing plays. But just don't ask her about, don't ask her about the Palestinians or don't talk about that stuff. And so I was never taken very seriously. The horror of it is that suddenly I became this anti-Zionist Jew who needed to be dealt with after October 2023. And I was unprepared for that because I just assumed that people were going to be able to see what was happening with the bombs and the total destruction and the ethnic cleansing and friends of mine literally being displaced four times and whole families being killed. I just assumed that people would be able to see that. But instead, they doubled down. And instead, I started becoming the focus point of their hate and rage, which was so weird.
But we live in dystopian times because I'm older than you, and I did my dissertation in the 1980s on wars of national liberation. Are they legal or legitimate under modern international law? Under John Dugard, who's now part of the legal team that took Israel to the ICJ. And it was a case for Palestine. And I completed that. And then I wanted to go further. And I was offered, I was told to do something more Jewish, okay, to avoid the Palestinian issue, okay? in it, not directly, indirectly. And I said to them, you know what, thank you, no, thank you. You know what, I'm just doing this because this is what I believe in. I mean, the 1980s was quite a challenging time because it was the PLO had just started developing, Arafat was. And firstly, as being part of the Greek community, the Greek-speaking community, was also a challenge.
Yes.
Because I remember at the time, during that same period, I lived in an area that was under the United Party that fell apart, so our constituency was open for grabs. And they came to the National Ruling Party, came to speak to get the next election, to win the next election. And I went with my dad, who couldn't drive. And we went to this big tent that was in Bedford View then. And on the stage, together with the candidate, was the chairman of the Greek community. I was livid, absolutely livid, because he was the chairman of a cultural community. He did not represent me. And I kept on heckling. My poor father, to his credit, didn't say a word, just kept on moving away from me further and further. It was fine. He didn't tell me to stop. He didn't say a word. The next time he just went with someone else. But support of apartheid and the support of the Jewish community together was visible from very, very early. Very, very early. And it's terrifying that we still don't.
The 80s in particular.
And it's terrifying to see that people aren't identifying.
The 80s were a great example. Yeah. I mean, the story that you've just told, I had a very similar thing where one of my friends at school. So I went to Cyril Dean Primary School, just around the corner from Bedford View. And that was obviously.
I went to Athlone Girls High School.
I wish I had gone to Athlone Girls High School. I went to King David School for Rich Jews. And that's when I really started understanding what was going on. I should have gone to Athlone. I was zoned to go to Athlone. And in fact, a lot of the people from Cyril Dean Primary ended up at Athlone. But so I remember one of the people I was at school with, Lauren, whatever his name was, her father, a nice Jewish man from Orange Grove, stood for the National Party. And I remember my father going absolutely berserk, like he could not believe it. And my father had a filthy mouth. He would swear. And he was disgusted, I remember, by that. But at the same time, I mean, my father was also a Zionist. So he was, you know, he was horrified that a Jew could stand with the National Party and be such a racist. But at the same time, he was a Zionist.
Tell me, how did October the 7th, 2023 change your life? In addition to the fact that the horror that unfolded afterwards, but how did that day change your life and your standing within the Jewish community? Or the South African community?
Well, I mean, I've always been a little bit of an outcast in terms of the Jewish community, but I've always been celebrated as a Jew in the creative community. So when I wrote my book, and my book did very, very well, my book was only published in June 2023. So it's like June, July, August, September, October. So it wasn't even 5 months, but the Jewish Report had celebrated me, and I was splashed all over they were interviewing me, and I had recently, I'd done a theatre production with this lovely coloured actress, Chantal Stanfield, called From Kusistus to Knedlach, and it was very much about an interracial and interfaith marriage. And so, there was all of that stuff going on. And in fact, in the play, I was very careful about highlighting my own anti-racist and certainly anti-supremacist, or at least anti-Zionist stance. But it was, that was easy to avoid. But the minute October the 7th happened and I started speaking out and being a vocal member of South African Jews for a Free Palestine, and being one of the lone voices of Jewish anti-Zionists in South Africa, because the Jewish community in South Africa is very conservative. They are still very racist, and they are 99% Zionist. It was suddenly I became the couple. And I became the self-loathing Jew, and I became the threat, you know, the external threat to the Jewish community. And then what also?
Can I interrupt you there? Yeah. Explain what a kapo is, please, because not everyone knows that.
Yeah, a kapo is the word that was given to Jews in the during the Holocaust who sold out other Jews or even members of their own family in order to save their skins and to save the lives of their families. It was a terrible position to be put in because it was a Sophie's choice position where people had to either not be a couple and not be a sellout or suffer those consequences or save their own families and sell out to other people. So it's now used commonly as a slur by Zionists, for anti-Zionists. And it's always so interesting for me. What's so interesting for me about this whole thing is it's absolutely clear that anti-Zionists are anti-violence. That's the idea behind it. And yet we are met with such abhorrence and with such hideous violence by the Zionists. I mean, I received a couple of days ago, the beginning of this week, someone sent me a direct message on Facebook, which went like that. And this is someone I don't know. I hope you get cervical cancer and die a painful death. May you rot in hell.
I wonder what makes people want to, or the need to actually send messages like that. How much hate and self-loathing to me, because for me to send you such a message, I can't like myself either.
I don't think it's that. I actually think it's such cognitive dissonance and such willful blindness. Because if you go and look at this man's profile on Facebook, it looks like one of his family members died of cancer and he's raised money for cancer and now he's wishing that on me. I mean, it's so far removed from any kind of anything. It makes no sense at all. I don't actually know how to describe it. We know that Zionists inside and outside the illegal state of Israel have dehumanized Palestinians to the point where they literally don't see Palestinians as human. And they see Palestinian children as potential threats. So they have to kill children. So in case the children grow up and want to kill them. And of course, we know this story because we grew up in South Africa and we understand die rooi gevaar, the communist threat, and we understand die swart gevaar, and that whites needed to protect themselves from the night of the long knives, that because people were going to come and kill you in your bed. And that was literally the propaganda. And I think in Israel, like, I heard this horrible story. A friend of mine's parents went to go and live in Israel on a kibbutz. They made aliyah. They went to go and live there. They were liberal Zionists. They, you know, they believed that Palestinians were a problem that needed to be solved. Literally, this is the kind of language. They were on kibbutz and they fell pregnant. And this woman had a baby on the kibbutz. And the midwife or the person who delivered the baby literally said, "Oh, congratulations. What a beautiful boy. May he grow up to be a fighter pilot." And that was her point of realizing that that's where it starts. The child has just been born, and the propaganda and the mythologizing and the brainwashing and the eugenics and the all of that stuff starts there. So now if you can imagine that this started pre 1948, you know, Herzl, but also, the terrorists that were in Palestine at the time, in sort of from 1929 onwards, you know, the Haganah and the Irgun, they were raging right-wing terrorists that were blowing up buildings and bombing things and slaughtering Palestinians, and that's where it started. Those were those ideas. Might is right. Very Trump, very fascist, very unapologetic.
Mm.
So that's where it started. And if you have a look at what's happening on the West Bank, it's that.
Mm. I mean, when I watch that woman, what's the that witch from the West Bank? What's her name?
I can't even. What is her name?
That's okay, but let's not give her any publicity. But what? Just watching her.
She's the same woman whose daughter committed suicide because of ritual rapes that she experienced all the way through her childhood.
No, but the one is a minister. The other one is a woman that's actually helping the settlers move into, she's encouraging the settlers to move into the West Bank and enjoying the fact that they provoke the Palestinians and then they can shoot them.
Yeah.
Anyway, tell me, it's a problem I have. How do you balance the frustration and the rage? I battle every day, and I've just been through pneumonia for 6 weeks. And it's taking slow to recuperate. And I think absorbing all this horror and dehumanization and lack of accountability and children, young Palestinian boys getting shot in testicles, how do you balance it in your life? Not balance, manage it is a better word. Because we don't sleep, we get sick. How can we keep ourselves healthy? Because getting sick should not be an option for us.
So I find it very difficult. I find it very, very, very difficult to balance. The one thing that has happened is obviously I've lost a lot of friends, and I don't speak to anyone in my family at all. But I have developed and forged a beautiful new community who I am able to reach out to and who do support me and help me in incredibly profound ways. And so I'm very, very grateful to that. I mean, it's a kind of interfaith community. It's an interracial community. And that's the one thing that gives me hope and encouragement. And the other thing is that constant reminder that I'm in my fields, but Palestinians are in their lives, and that actually that's a constant balance for me, and that's what balances it. But also the knowledge, and I have to say this, like, it took me a while to recognize this, and I don't know if you've also found this, but I have found that I do get messages from Palestinians. Sometimes they're circuitous, they come from somewhere else and I end up receiving the message. But Palestinians are grateful for whatever we can do. Whatever we can do, just as long as we don't forget them. You know, this is a long haul thing for them. This is, that Palestinians are not surprised by what's happening to them. This is, in a weird kind of way, it's taken this to actually make the world even aware of Palestinians. People didn't know that there was Palestine. People didn't know that there were Palestinians. And I think at least there's that.
I have to agree with you, because I belong to a few regional networks of women peace builders. And in these networks, you've got Palestinian women. And they are grateful. They are grateful for the fact that we are speaking out.
Exactly.
And that every now and there's this solidarity, because we will not hear from the Palestinian woman for a few days. You'll say, how's Jane doing? Is she okay? So this constant having their backs in some way is the least, it's the least we could be doing. But it's something that they do appreciate, because they know their name and their plight needs to be remained in the public sphere.
Yes, that's what Susan Abulawa always says. Nothing has prepared her for the violence and the savagery and the the grotesquerie of how the psychopathic Israelis are behaving. But at least people know that they are Palestinians now, because she's felt like her whole life, she, you know, as a Palestinian was erased up until this point. So at least there is that.
What else can we do?
I don't know.
Can we do anything else?
So I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm in a situation where I've lost a lot of work. My relationship with work has always been kind of tenuous because I am a freelance person and self-create my work. But it's really tough. It's really tough. I think we have to do what we can. Write, speak, attend, protest, march, rinse and repeat.
Let's now turn a little bit to Megan, the person. You do theatre and you write. You do theatre as in improvisation, which I love the sound of, because in the world we live in, nothing is planned. Yeah. You've got to actually react to a situation as it comes up. So tell us a little bit about your work.
So I love talking about improvisation, because improvisation is not only this beautiful thing that I get to perform at least once a month on stage, but I also teach it and facilitate improv classes. And it's actually, for me, it's the most profound philosophy to live by, because it is a yes and philosophy. Any improviser will tell you yes and that's literally the philosophy that keeps the door of possibility open. And it's so beautiful. I mean, just the idea of living in or being present in a space where you're asking, what if? What if? So you're opening the door to possibility instead of shutting down and going, what's the worst thing that can happen, and believing that the worst thing will. But the other thing that I love about improv, which is very different from traditional kind of performance, is that improv really gives you an opportunity to work as a team. So you are outside of yourself. It's work that's beyond your ego, because you're always thinking about your scene partner. You're also always thinking about your teammates. You're always thinking, how can I help them? How can I improve what they're doing? How can I make them look and feel and be fantastic? So improv for me is like, it's like having the best and healthiest drink that can sustain you. And I'm just very, very grateful that I've been able to adapt that improv energy into other areas of my life. And obviously it also impacts on the other areas of creativity, writing as well.
You also have a Substack.
I also have a Substack. I mean, Substack is new for me. It's very frustrating. In South Africa, if you have a Substack, you can't be paid. So I can't, because it's an American thing, and you've got to be paid into an American account. So I've got a Substack and nobody can contribute financially to it. So that's a bit frustrating, but it is a very good platform for me to find my voice from a political writing point of view.
Well, I've got to start using Substack, because I used to be a journalist. I don't write anymore. I'm finding podcasting a easier medium for me. I think maybe it's because I'm impatient. So I start writing and I run away with my thoughts and I get totally lost. But I've got to start getting back into Substack, and I should be using these podcasts as contributing.
You should.
You also do tarot cards.
I do.
How did that come up? Where did that come up?
It's been many, many, many years. So I basically inherited my first pack of tarot cards in the most bizarre circumstances. I had a friend who used to run these themed parties in Cape Town. And one of the parties was a kind of French impressionist party. And he used to cast all the people to come to the party as characters. And he cast me as the tarot reader, was the fortune teller. And I had a friend who had tarot cards. And he, I asked if I could borrow them for the party. And I pretended to read tarot for everyone at the party. And I was quite the hit. So, the next party was at the Long Street Baths, which is kind of, it was going to be a Victorian party. But in the space of time from the one party to the next, the friend who had given me his tarot cards died. And so his tarot cards obviously became my tarot cards. And I read for friends for years and years and years. I always used to read for friends on birthdays. And I read tarot. Occasionally I'd be invited to be the tarot reader at other parties. And, then during lockdown, at the exact same time as my marriage imploded and we were in the COVID world, I started reading tarots, and friends of mine around the world made contact with me and shared, my number with their friends. And so it became this thing that I actually do. So every day I do a one card reading on social media. But I also do 10 card readings for people, and I charge for those.
I have to admit, I've always been intrigued by tarot cards, and I sometimes read the Greek coffee cup.
Stunning!
And it started as a pastime with my mother, and I used to sit and look at pictures and shapes, and it turned out that on 3 or 4 occasions, I gave people news that they weren't expecting and turned out to be true. And I think it freaked me out for a moment. But I'm always, always intrigued about turning tarot cards or believing in signs. And despite my practicality, I do believe in the intangible, that things come through that you just got to recognize and go with. Not fight, just go with and recognize.
Yeah. I think what blocks us sometimes with that kind of stuff, what blocks us is our fear. We get scared because I think that there's so much information coming and going from all the different places. And I think that sometimes it's just hard to accept that and scary. But I think that when we surrender to it, then it becomes beautiful.
When you surrender to it, you actually understand that it's not to be feared.
Exactly.
And it's also not to be taken literally. It's to be taken in the spirit that it comes to you.
So I have to just tell you that while we've been talking, I drew you a card. And I'm going to show you the card I drew for you, which is the Queen of Swords.
The Queen of Swords?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Isn't she just magnificent?
Thank you.
And so when
she's magnificent,
when the queen or king or page or knight comes up, then the card is really about aspects of self. Like, what are the aspects of the Queen of Swords that you have? And it's really beautiful because it's about the Queen of Swords is about truth and about communication and about, words and expression and independence, but more than anything, it's about a search for truth. It's someone who values truth really highly, truth and communication.
Well, this is the last 4 or 5 months of really being a trial for me. A trial in life. There's been a shift in me that I thought I had it all together, but I was okay with where I was. I had my mojo, and then suddenly something shifted and I don't know what it was. And I'm still trying to find my way back to my truth, but my truth, it also makes me a bit of money because we need to pay the rent. We really need to pay the rent. Megan, is there anything else you want to say before we close?
I want to ask you a question. I want to ask you about what it's like being an ex-South African in Cyprus.
I left South Africa in 1985. I married a Greek and I moved to Greece until 2000. And then I came here. I love being an ex-South African because I think despite apartheid, I think we learned to live with diversity inadvertently. And even though my parents didn't support my views, but supported the apartheid system, we had Indian friends. My mother used to make every type of food you could imagine. I had my Jewish friends and I'd go to Rosh Hashanah celebrations. I had my Catholic friends and I'd go to singing Christmas carols on Christmas Eve. So to me, I love that part of being an ex-South African because I bring with me a diversity that I didn't, at the time I thought quite the opposite. When you live in that isolation and the separateness, you don't realize that you do mix, you do learn, you do, there is osmosis between the communities.
Yeah.
And the other part of being ex-South African means that whenever I go to a peace table, talking about peace or mediation or conflict, I bring the Cypriot context with me and the South African context.
Right.
So I've got the apartheid, having lived through apartheid and the, I mean, I was at uni in 1976, when the Soweto riots, and we had gone downtown to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the matinee, and we came out of the movies, and the whole world had exploded with people rushing to the train station and pre-mobile phones. Fortunately, we'd gone in two cars, eight of us, but our parents nowhere. So I lived through it, and I'm very, very grateful to the fact that, firstly, I had parents that just wanted me to be safe, okay? They knew they couldn't control me, and I don't think they wanted to.
Yeah.
I had educated parents and parents that wanted me to be happy, so I think they saw the passion in me. And I'm also grateful because I had really good, firstly, I've always been curious, but I had really good professors at uni.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that I had good professors, the fact that, I mean, when I did my postgraduate degree in international relations and I chose international law, the three people in the class was me, a Cypriot, a South African and an Irish person, three divided communities. So I carry this division with me. My son laughs at me. He says to me, you take it everywhere we go. So I think an ex-South African living abroad and doing peace work or in this context actually inadvertently gives me a dimension that not everyone has of having lived in two different contexts. And people talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission a lot. And they assume that it having taken place in South Africa, that was a perfect solution. It was a solution,
no,
but it wasn't perfect and it didn't solve a lot of problems, nor did it avoid the racism and the hate that came afterwards. So I think it's given me an advantage, and it's given me an advantage because I was also an active citizen as in South Africa.
Exactly.
I was in the anti-apartheid movement. I was always going to stuff. I was get angry with injustices.
Right.
And as I said, I grew up in a family that my father had a restaurant business. I never saw him being disrespectful to his employees.
Yeah.
He taught me respect because he practiced respect.
Right.
So I never could be rude to the help. It was always please and thank you. And if I could do it for myself, I bloody well needed to do it for myself. So I was taught respect at home. By example, not by words. So I think I'm very grateful for the fact that I was born in South Africa during that period. And it sounds quite bizarre when you think of what happened at the time. And the inequalities and the injustices and the Steve Bikos and the 190 days without trial detentions. But I think it has made me a better person. It just certainly has given me a perspective that when people say, oh, you're also South African born. So it adds to my living through division, building bridges across division.
Yes.
And learning, bringing lessons from division.
Thank you for sharing.
So like you, very grateful to have been brought up in a family that didn't ostracize me or oppress me because I did not agree with what they agreed with.
Beautiful.
And recognized that I was an individual person and I needed to live my truth. Anyway, thank you for being with me, Megan. Hopefully, I don't know if I'm going to come to South Africa sometime soon, but
I promise
to come down and see Bernadette as well, because she always shouted at me, you come and you don't come down to Cape Town.
It would be great to meet you in person.
I have to come. This year, I can't come because I'm becoming a grandma.
I believe so.
I'm becoming grandma this year. So this year, I need to stay in, not I want to stay in Cyprus with the new grandchild, but I definitely will come back because I've got lots of family there. My sister's got grandkids, so
beautiful.
There's always a connection. So Lovely to meet with you. Courage to both of us.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
To fight the right fight and to keep our moral compass in place.
Indeed.
And always a reminder that with all that we are going through, the Palestinians have it so much worse.
Exactly.
So much worse.
Exactly. Let us be, that must always be foremost in our minds.
Yes, yes. Okay. Thank you, Megan. Thank you.
And our hearts, obviously.
Yes, and our hearts, of course. So thank you, Megan.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to the listeners. And I will put your the link for your Substack on the when I upload your
That would be great. And podcast. If you could also just put my book there as well.
Of course. Send me the link.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. You and have a lovely rest of the day.
You too.
Bye.
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 The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.